So I think we are ready to embark further on our immediate goal of developing Green's function methods to solve inhomogeneous second-order partial differential equations, and focusing for the moment on the Poisson equation. So as I showed last time, if we have a linear, anytime you have linear differential, or in our case, PD partial differential equation, which if it's an inhomogeneous equation, right, you have some operator L acting on an unknown solution is equal to some inhomogeneity, like so. Then again, the general strategy we learn when we learn how to solve differential equations is we can define a particular solution of this, which might not in general satisfy the boundary conditions of the problem. And then we can always add any to this, any solution of the homogeneous equation, of which, like if it's a second order ordinary differential equation, we know there would be two linearly independent solutions, right? There would be two constants that in general determine this solution of the homogeneous differential equation. And so the most general solution of this that you can make of the original problem plus the boundary conditions would then be phi particular plus phi general of the homogeneous equation, where all the unknown integration constants, two in the case of an ordinary differential equation, it might be a very large number in the case of a partial differential equation like we're mostly solving here. But in general, this can then be adjusted, all that uncertainty, unknowns in this general solution of the homogeneous equation you use to fit the boundary conditions of any given problem. That's the big picture of the strategy we're talking about. So in the present problem, we are interested in solving some Green's functions, which is a special case of what I just said. And for the Poisson equation, the Green's function we are interested in solving for is del squared of g of x, x prime is minus 4 pi delta of x minus x prime. Should warn you that this constant is not totally standard. So anytime you embark on a new pasture of Green's function calculations, you might need to check what the constants are that were used to define the Green's functions before you just start grabbing Green's function formulas out of references and using them. They might have chosen some of them a different constant here. And so here we have an inhomogeneous partial differential equation. It just has a rather perhaps, if you haven't done much with Green's functions, a rather odd-looking inhomogeneity, which is a Dirac delta function, just a point source at the position x prime. So we already know that a particular solution of this is 1 over the absolute value of x minus x prime. So we talked about last time. And to this, we will need in general to add solutions of the homogeneous equation, which I'm calling this capital F function. And again, by definition, the homogeneous equation it obeys then is this equals zero. And right, since this is a general PDE, it has many unknown constants, right? There are an infinite number of solutions of this equation. So choosing the right one that will give the desired boundary conditions on G is the important step.
Yeah. So G is just chosen because of physics, electrostatics, right? This particular G is a physics G.
I'm not quite sure I understand. You can view it as physics or you can view it as math. I mean, there are other problems where you might be interested in this Green's function other than electrostatics, like, I mean, gravity, for instance, gravitational potentials.
Did we pick this G1 over X minus X prime angle because this gives us the point source?
Right, this satisfies this inhomogeneity. It's one solution that does that. I could have written something else. I could have written 1 over x minus x prime plus x. Okay, that also satisfies that, but I didn't pick it. So if we had, then this f would be changed. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is the problem we're immediately trying to solve. I mean, when we're doing radiation problems, we'll be really interested in Green's functions of this operator, for instance, the Helmholtz equation operator for the wave equation. Yeah.
If we find one f of x, x prime, which satisfies the boundary conditions for our problems, then we found g, and that's the only g for the problem because of the unit.
Exactly. Yeah. So if by hook or by crook we can find this and it satisfies all our boundary conditions, then you can just declare the victory and use that Green's function in the other formulas of the chapter to actually calculate the solution, desired solution of Poisson's equation in the context. Okay, so one way this is found is by the method of images, which is one of the methods I want to talk about today. It's not the only method, but for a class of problems, it gives a rather fast way to obtain this function f. But I'll come to that later. Okay, so the other thing, let's not forget, one thing I mentioned is the overcompleteness of Cauchy boundary conditions. And so we want to avoid that to get a unique, well-defined solution to our problem. And so basically, to solve that problem, the inconsistency of Cauchy boundary conditions in which you would have terms both with a specified phi on a boundary, right? Remember, Cauchy means you would have a surface around the volume V where you're trying to solve the problem. And with Cauchy boundary conditions, you'd be given both phi on the surface and d phi dn on the surface. This overspecifies the problem. And there were terms in the... I guess I haven't written that yet. There were terms in the equation I wrote, not for G, but last time with just with this particular solution that looked like either this times the d phi dn, if you remember, or the derivative of this with respect to the normal times phi on the boundary. So we can basically solve this inconsistency, and this is Jackson's strategy. And basically, we'll choose the Green's function to kill one of the two surface terms. If we kill either the term, there will be a term that looks like G on the surface. There will be another term that looks like DGDN prime on the surface. And if we choose our boundary conditions, one of these will vanish or be a trivial constant in some cases. So let me try to get to that. But that's a little bit where we're going. And the strategy will, the derivation will start with, again, Green's theorem. We'll go back to that like we did last time. We'll again pick as little phi in the Green's theorem. We'll choose that to be phi of x prime. But now for psi, instead of picking that to be immediately just 1 over x minus x prime, we'll pick that to be the Green's function. And essentially all that same algebra we went through last time goes through now. Remember, we used, when I picked psi to be 1 over the absolute value of x minus x prime, we used the fact that del squared of that is the minus 4 pi delta function. And that's still true. It's still true that g will obey this equation. Okay. But now we will look at two cases of boundary conditions on the Green's function. And in particular, we'll pick what I'll call the Dirichlet Green's function. Which vanishes on the surface S. Or we will pick the Neumann Green's function. Call it Gn of x, x prime. And this Neumann boundary condition, Green's function, has the derivative, the normal derivative of G on S specified. We'll see, it can't actually be chosen to be zero on the surface. That would lead to another inconsistency. But I'll say more about that later. Yeah.
So when you're saying vanishes,
you're
saying it's equal to zero?
Yeah, vanishes means equals zero. I remember I had a postdoc in France, gave a seminar about my research. It was a group of experimental AMO physicists in Orsay. And I was showing some interesting features about wave functions I had calculated. And I said, look, these points where the wave function is zero. And someone in the audience, actually a well-known professor, he raised his hand and he said, well, is the wave function zero there or is the square? And I kind of did a double take. I said, well, actually, both are zero. So the subject can be confusing at times. But vanishes means it's zero. And also its square is zero. Don't forget that. So let's review. Remember what we do when we do this derivation. write out the terms 5x prime with Green's theorem now with these choices of phi and psi. And with the independent integration variable, I'm choosing to be x prime. I'll still leave it general at this point. There's the volume integral over our volume V that we've decided to use. Again, it does not necessarily mean a physical volume of any real object. It can be just a mathematical volume. This del squared, again, we'll plug in minus 4 pi delta, x minus x prime. This one, we will plug in minus rho of x prime over epsilon naught. And then that will equal the surface difference of the two surface terms implied by Green's theorem, 5x prime, the gradient of g with respect to x prime dotted into the normal vector at the surface, the outward normal, which is, we're using this abbreviation for that, remember, dg dn prime. And then minus g of x prime x d phi of x prime dn prime integrated over the primed surface coordinates. Okay. And so evaluating this first line then gives, assuming we are talking about observation points in the volume of interest, so the delta function will integrate to 1. We'll get minus 4 pi 5x, which is the quantity we want, plus the volume integral of the charge per unit volume, rho of x prime over epsilon naught, g of x prime x d cubed x prime. Yeah.
So do you mean, so is that delta g over delta n prime, the g of x prime?
Partial, you mean?
The partial, yeah. So is that x prime and x prime?
X prime x. Oh, sorry, this is not a prime. Is that what you were wondering?
Yeah.
Yeah.
These first two lines are just Green's theorem.
Yeah, the first two lines are Green's theorem. Now I'm evaluating the volume integral. Yeah. Okay, now an aside that I'm going to just assert without proving. The Green's function is actually a symmetric matrix, which allows me to rewrite this in a slightly different notation. It turns out that's guaranteed for the Dirichlet-Green's function. One can prove that. For the Neumann-Green's function, it is not guaranteed if you just calculate the Neumann-Green's function. But one can always choose the Neumann-Green's function so that it is true. So let's just, from now on, basically assume that this is true. If you really want to get into the mathematics of why that's true, you might want to consult some of my favorite references like Morrison-Feshbach or Courant and Hilbert, Volume 1. But I don't want to get into every arcane mathematical detail. Well, one other identity I'll use at times is that the derivative dg dn prime of x prime x is also d by dn prime g of xx prime. So both of these symmetry relations are sometimes useful. Okay, so I claim then I can write our key equation, which you might mark with an asterisk in your notes, for phi of x. This has a volume integral as part of the solution in general. G of x, x prime, rho of x prime, d cubed x prime. And, okay, again, we're talking about some volume V. It's got some charges maybe inside. There could be charges outside, which won't be integrated over in this formula. You're only integrating over this volume V. And then you have the difference of the two surface terms in general, 4 pi. G of x, x prime, d phi of x prime, dn prime, minus dg of x, x prime, dn prime, times phi of x prime, integrate over the area. Okay. You might want to just, you know, whenever you see a formula like this, it was derived from a derivation of a few lines, you know, do a quick units check. Remember, we saw already our particular solution for G had dimensions 1 over length, right? So G is dimensions 1 over length. So it's clear this first term is just Coulomb's law dimensions, right? It's going to be charge per unit volume times volume differential volume element. That'll be charge over a distance and epsilon naught. That'll have units of electric potential. What about this term? Okay, so what are the units of that? D phi dn prime. Sorry? Volts per meter. Right. Everybody see that? Right, because it's a gradient of a potential, right? It's a potential over a length. And so it's a potential over a length, and the G is a 1 over a length, and then we have a differential area. And similarly, this units work out here too. Okay, so anyway, that's a check I often make on my derivations. I just do a quick units check. Sometimes that's hard if you're using atomic units or natural units and you've set every constant to 1. But if you don't do that, you can use this as a nice test and help eliminate a wide class of algebra errors. Let's see, where are we? Okay, so that is the equation I wanted. So now let's apply it to the two separate cases I wrote here before, the Dirichlet and the Neumann boundary condition case. For these two standard cases, the first being the Dirichlet boundary condition problem, remember, this means what information you're given is phi of x is given to you on S. Okay. So, again, all the effects of these outside charges, outside your volume you've chosen, all their effects are going to be encapsulated in the values of phi on S. Maybe you measured it, for instance. And then you don't need to know what charges or things are outside of S, outside of the volume V. don't care. All the information you care about is this value of phi on the surface. And then we will solve this problem using the Dirichlet-Green's function. Gd of xx prime equals 0 for either x on s or x prime on s. And then you can see that if g is 0, right, this term goes away. You don't need to know d phi dn prime on s. Just knowing phi on s is enough with the Dirichlet problem, the Dirichlet boundary condition, Green's function, to then give the complete solution to the problem. Okay. And so for the Dirichlet problem, which means the Green's function was chosen to be 0 on s, but the potential is given on s. And phi then will be the volume integral of the Dirichlet-Green's function times the charge per unit volume for 4 pi epsilon naught d cubed x prime, and then minus 1 over 4 pi surface integral of the partial of the Dirichlet-Green's function, then outward normal of x, x prime, times phi of x prime, which you assume for this problem was given to you. So the derivatives is not relevant anymore. It's not used in the solution for this choice of boundary conditions on the Green's function. And then for the Neumann case, there's just one additional subtlety. Otherwise, it's the kind of straightforward generalization of what I just said for the Dirichlet. Yeah. Thanks. You're right, of course. One thing that's important in this class is to listen to what I mean rather than what I write or say. They aren't always the same. Okay, Neumann boundary conditions. Now, we'll assume d phi of x prime, dn prime, is given on the surface. And we specify the Neumann-Green's function on S. And the analogous logic might imply that you would guess we would set it equal to 0. Turns out that won't work. So let me explain why. We can make it a constant, but if it were 0, it would cause an inconsistency. Here is why. Remember, when we are solving for the Green's function, it's like we had a point charge, right, inside our volume at some point, x prime. Gauss's law guarantees that the integral of the E dot dA around this due to a point charge must equal the magnitude of the point charge, right? That's Gauss's law, except for getting all the constants straight. So basically, we know that the surface integral dg dn prime of x, x prime, integrated over the surface by the divergence theorem, this is equal to the volume integral of del prime squared g n of x, x prime d cubed x prime. That's just the divergence theorem, right? Del prime squared is del prime dot into del gn. And this is minus 4 pi, right? And so basically by choosing, if we choose instead of 0, if we choose this to be a constant, minus 4 pi over the surface area, the total surface area S, then it eliminates this inconsistency. Okay, I think I said that rather clumsily, but I think you see that there, Gauss's law tells us that there has to be a constraint in order to avoid this inconsistency. Yeah, right. Exactly.
And G, for what we're doing, it's a potential, right?
Well, it's a potential of a point charge at the position x prime with all the other boundary conditions on G. Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's a good physical way of saying it. Yeah. You know, that creates electric field lines going out from it. And so you couldn't have the integral of the field outward normal integrated be zero. No. Good point. Okay. So collect that into one final expression then for the Neumann boundary condition problem, where someone hands us d phi dn everywhere on the surface. The final solution for phi of x in terms of the Neumann-Green's function will again have a volume integral integrated over the charges within the volume, x, x prime, rho of x prime, d cubed x prime, 4 pi epsilon naught. Then there is a surface term we expect. The Neumann-Green's function times the derivative of the potential, which was given, assumed given, but now we can't say that the other surface term is killed because it had to obey this property, the derivative term of the Green's function, which is different than the Dirichlet problem, where we're able to kill totally the second term. But now we get this term, which is surface integral over phi of x prime dgn dn prime of x, x prime dA prime. Right, but now this, with this boundary condition, means, let me simplify that final term. It might concern you because we said we didn't need to know phi on the surface. And that's actually still true, but let me show you why. So the last term in that surface integral is minus 1 over 4 pi with this boundary condition on the Green's function, 4 pi over s. We can factor it out of the integral, and we just have the surface integral of phi of x prime over the surface, which I could denote, if you like, cancel the 4 pi's. This is minus, I guess I left off the minus in the notes, you might add that. It's minus the average value of phi over the surface. Yeah?
Is this
4 pi over s, we always have this for Neumann boundary conditions.
It's always exactly that.
Yeah, that would... That's part of the specification of GN. Oh, that's my mistake. So the mistake was here, not later. Thanks. Yeah, thanks. That makes more sense. It should equal the average value of phi on s. Okay, so... Basically, this last term is just giving the mean value of phi on the surface, and this is just a constant, and which won't affect the electric field or any subsequent observables, because we always have the freedom to change the potential by a constant without changing any physics. And so it's usually even dropped. Usually you don't even carry that through subsequent calculations, although you can, and it won't affect anything. So the final formula with that in mind is usually written just with these two terms here for the Neumann boundary condition problem. There's one third choice that Jackson doesn't mention, but I sometimes use in my own work in various contexts. Besides the Dirichlet and Neumann choices of the boundary conditions, a third possibility is to, it's sometimes convenient to choose the boundary conditions on G to be exactly the same as the boundary conditions on the desired phi. And basically what that does is it kills both of the surface terms. And now for that choice of boundary conditions, the full solution is only the volume integral. Okay, so that concludes this general development. We'll get in soon to actually calculating and seeing examples of applying these. But first I want to talk a little about energy in electrostatics. Any other questions about that? Of a problem. You could have the Dirichlet problem where you specify phi on s. You could have the Neumann case where you specify d phi dn on s. Third choice is where you know, like the logarithmic derivative, you know maybe d phi dn over phi on s. then if you choose the Green's function to have exactly that same logarithmic derivative on the surface, it kills all the surface terms. Well, I'm not sure we'll use this, but anyway, it is useful when you apply all these ideas to like the Schrodinger wave equation and doing scattering theory. Okay, energy in electrostatics. You've all seen this in your undergraduate physics, but there are some interesting subtleties that come up in talking about it. So we want to try to discuss it rather carefully. And so basically, what we call the potential energy of a collection of charges distributed in some way in space let's call them Q1 up to Q sub n is basically the energy needed to assemble them from infinity. Bring them each one of them in with very slowly, so you have no kinetic energy to worry about. Bring them in very slowly from infinity to their final positions. How much energy was needed to bring Q1 to X1 up to Qn at Xn? Okay. And that's the potential energy of the system, and I guess we'll use the symbol U for that. And one way to calculate this is to bring them in one by one. Okay, so start, bring in Q1. Take Q1 from infinity, bring it into X1. Okay. And we'll call the amount of energy required to do that U1. And that, of course, is zero, because that's the first charge. There's no electric field present that we are bringing in this Q1 that we have to work against. Okay. But to bring in the second one, to bring Q2 to position X2, we will have to fight against or be drawn in, if it's attractive, the electrical force produced by the electric field produced of Q1. Okay, so that's U2 will be Q2 times the electric potential produced by Q1, which is pi epsilon naught absolute X1 minus X2. And then we can continue that down to the nth charge, will be the magnitude of the nth charge. And then we'll have to add the potential energy associated with the electric potential due to all the n minus 1 charges that were already previously brought in. To n minus 1. And so finally, the total energy in assembling all of them, we have to sum up U1 to UN, U capital N, will be the total potential energy and write it this way, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, sum from I equals 1 to n. For each I, we sum from j from I plus 1 to n. And then we have qi, qj, for 4 pi epsilon naught, absolute value, distance from xi to xj. My God, you're right. Sorry about that. Thanks. Okay, another way that this is sometimes written, there's nothing wrong with what we wrote there, but it's sometimes written in a different way. One over eight pi epsilon naught, and simply sum over all pairs of I and j where they are different. Which is, this is implies a double sum, but omitting the terms where I is equal to j, which of course would be infinity and would be a little bit awkward to account for. I think I called this equation 1 in the notes for later reference. Okay. And one way to think about what are the terms when xi equals xj, what would they refer to? Those you can think of, they would be sort of the self-energy in a charge. Okay. Which, if these were are really truly point charges, these would be infinite. Right? If you imagine, like taking a small ball of charge. People have tried to make models like this and now shrink the size of this down to zero. The energy of this charge interacting with the electric field, with the other bits of charge in the sphere, will be infinite. Okay, so usually we aren't interested in that kind of infinity because we aren't pulling apart the charge inside an electron. But in quantum electrodynamics, you have to worry about that a little more carefully, a lot more carefully. And that leads to renormalization theory in quantum electrodynamics. Hugely successful theory. Nobody knows why. But it seems to work and predict things like the anomalous magnetic moment of an electron to about 10 decimal places. Kind of amazing. And even got some people a Nobel Prize. Okay, so we're often interested in continuous distribution of charges, and we'd like to generalize this to a continuous distribution of charge. So I would like to argue that we can generalize in the most natural way to having a charge predominant volume distributed in space in some way. And then the natural generalization I claim would be 1 over 8 pi epsilon naught, the integral over rho of x times rho of x prime, d cubed x, d cubed x prime over x minus x prime. Right, so you have some charge distribution, rho, and you calculate the interaction of every little differential volume element at x with every little volume element at x prime, and sum them all up. kind of what the point charge formula says. I'm coming to talk about that. Yeah, I mean, you've hit on a key point, which I'm just about to go into. So if I haven't explained it in 5 minutes, ask again how I am thinking about that. Okay, so sometimes it's useful to think instead in terms of the electrostatic potential, which we already have, maybe calculated, perhaps using our Green's function toolkit. Like if we have no boundaries and we just have the usual integrating over all charges in the universe formula for the electrostatic potential. We start from this form, where there are no conducting boundaries and such, then I could rewrite this U as 1/2 the integral of rho of x, phi of x, d cubed x. Okay. And then, if you remember, what is rho? Rho is epsilon naught minus epsilon naught del squared phi. So if I plug that in, I can rewrite this U as an integral only involving phi. Minus epsilon naught over 2. The integral, now it's over all space, that's our volume we're talking about now in this derivation, phi of x times del squared phi of x. And applying the first theorem of theoretical physics, when in doubt, integrate by parts, yes. Except we call that in three dimensions something more like Green's identity or something like that. Then after applying Green's first identity, and because we chose an infinite volume, and we assume we're talking about a finite distribution of charges, we can neglect the surface terms at infinity. Then this gives an alternative form, U equals epsilon naught over 2, volume integral over all space of del U dot del U, which I'll just write as del U squared d cubed x. But the gradient of the electrostatic potential is what we call the electric field. And so we have epsilon naught over 2, the volume integral over all space of the magnitude of the electric field squared d cubed x. Okay, which is a pretty important formula for the energy stored in an electric field per unit volume. Okay, and so the way this formula is usually interpreted, still I haven't come to your question, but I'll be there in a minute, is that basically each little differential volume element in space where there is an electric field, it has an energy per unit volume in it, which is the magnitude of the energy in that volume, that differential volume, infinitesimally small, is the volume itself, then times the energy per unit volume, which we regard as the energy stored in the electric field. And so we often call that an energy density, electrostatic energy density. And of course, it has dimensions in SI units, joules per meter cubed. Okay. So when we started with Coulomb's law, we had a force on a charge due to other charges, right? Now, if we have other various charges that make an electric field, say at this point, like in this little volume element, they make an electric field here, then with the field concept, we sort of feel that there is sort of something there even when there's no test charge there to feel the electric force. That's Faraday's field concept, also Maxwell's. That there is not only an electric field, there's actually energy density in the field at that point. There's energy stored there. And to calculate the total energy in the universe, you have to do this integral over all volume elements. So it's sort of like, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound if no one's there to hear it? But we think that there is something there even if there's no test charge to feel it. Yeah. Of course. Thanks. Of course. Thanks. Okay, so now come to your point is that we have, when you stare at equation 2, is this equation 2? I think this is equation 2. And equation 1, if I already erased it. What was equation 1? Was that the point charge version? I think so. Yeah, that was the point charge version. Equation 2 is clearly positive definite, or non-negative, I should say. Whereas equation 1 obviously could be positive or negative 1. So these two equations are really not fully consistent. And the reason is that now we have not made this stipulation of omitting the self-energy terms. Okay, so this formula cannot be really applied, or this formula, to point charges. Basically, that's the conclusion. And if you care about physics related to that, you better just go on straight to quantum electrodynamics. Yeah, you had a question?
This is for static fields and static charges.
Yeah. This is all electrostatics.
So in this format, like version 2, you erase it that the energy of a point charge is infinite. So
no, the integral will converge if you have continuous distributions. But if you have point charges as well, then you should add their energy in by the point charge formula, but calculate the continuous charge distributions by this formula. You don't look happy at all with that. Yeah.
I was going to ask his question, so I'll ask him probably. So the self-energy is in there. In this one, the self-energy is in there. But you can infinitely divide it up. There's no nugget. There's no atom. There's no smallest charge. You keep on dividing it.
Right. Yeah. It's really continuously divisible all the way down. Yeah.
I can see this from this formula for zero integrating over x and x prime. So at some point x is going to equal x prime.
Okay, imagine choosing your origin of coordinates for the x prime integral, right, to be right on top of the singularity in x, then you have the volume element. You have the x squared in the numerator that cancels the singularity. So this integral converges if these are continuous functions. Let's see. So, for instance, let's look at this integral. Rho of x prime for a fixed x. We'll do the x prime integral first. D cubed x prime over x minus x prime. Okay? Now, this integral is just going to be some number at a given x. But this is an integral over all space. I can choose the coordinate origin wherever I want it for this integral. And if I choose it exactly at x, then it's this integral, right? And this has a d omega prime x prime squared dx prime. This makes this integrable. You still don't look happy at all about that.
Isn't that only if you're doing a spherical, the integration, like say if we're doing like a cube and just doing Cartesian coordinates, you don't have an x prime squared, right?
Well, okay, if I've proven the integral converges in one coordinate system, it better converge in all, right? It goes through zero, but it's a removable singularity. I can integrate x prime squared over x prime, dx prime. That's a removable singularity. Physicists are happy with that. A mathematician might say, oh my God, it's zero over zero. What should we do? Oh my God, I'm going to panic. But physicists say, okay, it's removable.
If
there are point charges, that's essentially what I said you should do. If there are point charges, you should use the point charge formula and for those. And if it's all continuous, you can just do this integral. But if it's all continuous, there's no divergence, period. So there's nothing to worry about, nothing you need to subtract.
Since the half epsilon naught mod e squared term contains the self energy as well, so that, does that mean that even in quantum electrodynamics this doesn't change, like this form of the energy density?
Yes, except then you have renormalization.
So like when we're dealing with a group of point charges, then we apply renormalization. But when we're dealing with continuous charges, even in QED, so then we can just define this.
Well, in QED there really aren't continuous charges. So I'm not quite sure I can answer your question. And I, again, full disclosure, I'm not an expert in QED. So there are other people in the department you should ask probably about issues like that. You were next. Right. Yeah.
When you write it down in terms of the charge density, there really are charge distributions that can make that positive or negative. Or does it end up being positive even though it might not be clear just staring at it?
I don't think so. I mean, it's an absolute square by this derivation.
Oh, equation 1.
Equation 2. Equation 1 was the point charge version, right, which doesn't have it can't be written as a square, but this version can be written as a square by this derivation. So even if there is a divergence, okay, there will be some big number there, and then you will, like renormalization theory, you just subtract the big number. Okay. Who cares if it's infinity? Okay. That's the basic point of view. Okay, I think we're ready to talk about a kind of a subtle point. I think I might have time to get through this. On electrostatic pressure. Okay, so I want to imagine a situation where we have charges spread on a conductor, and we know that, I think from all your undergraduate E&M, you know that in electrostatics, if you have charge on a conductor, it has to be on the outer, reside on the outer surface, outermost surface of the conductor. So let's set up a situation where we have charge per unit area, a surface charge density sigma on a conductor surface. And I want to convince you that the electrostatic forces cause an outward pressure on the surface at that point. And that's our goal, to calculate this. So let's set up a part of a surface that has a conductor here, and let's say vacuum outside. And we have sigma, so there are some charges on the surface. They could be negative, but let's say they're positive. And so we know how to calculate the electric field using Gauss's law, just infinitesimally outside. We can just make a Gaussian surface, a little Gaussian pillbox that extends into the conductor and encloses a surface area delta A. And assume that the height delta x is infinitesimal. And so we'll have an outward normal unit vector pointing out of the conductor. And we know then that the E field is zero inside the conductor. And so by Gauss's law, we know that the integral E dot dA is the charge enclosed, but just doing this integral over this infinitesimal area gives simply E delta A. Since E was zero from this surface, and there's nothing going out the sides because we made that infinitesimally tall. And so then that's equal to the charge enclosed sigma delta A over epsilon naught, or the E field just outside the conducting surface, this well-known result, sigma over epsilon naught times an outward normal unit vector. And so by our previous derivation, there is an energy density just outside the surface, which I'll write as a little lowercase u of x, epsilon naught over 2 e squared, so sigma squared over epsilon naught squared, which is the energy per unit volume right outside the conductor. Okay. And now I want to imagine that we take this little area element and move it up some tiny distance, which I will call delta x, which is not really this delta x. Sorry, I should have changed notation. So now we'll move the area element with the charge in the n-hat direction by a tiny distance delta x. And so the electric field will do some work in that. Namely, the electric field does this amount of work. And I should say, when we're calculating work, we don't want to include the work, the charge, the electric field contributed by these charges themselves are doing. We're trying to calculate use the force produced by all the other charges in the universe, not the force due to the charge itself, not that part of the electric field. So I'm trying to make that distinction. It might seem a little hokey. There are alternative ways to derive this, but this is a slightly heuristic way of thinking about this derivation. Okay, so that's sigma delta A times the electric field due to the other charges, and then times the distance moved. Okay, so now the problem is, how do we figure out the electric field due to all the other charges? And this is a slightly subtle argument, but I think it basically holds together. In my view, this is a rather subtle problem, because you have to find, well, we've already found the electric field, but that includes the electric field due to the charges that you're moving themselves. And so we want to find the field just due to the other charges in the universe. And to deduce this E other, I want to consider a comparison problem. I want to consider just having a thin layer of charge, sigma, that's not in a conductor. Okay, so just imagine a very thin, maybe spread on a dielectric material with the essentially unit dielectric constant. Okay, so what would be the electric field in this case? We know we can do the same argument, we can apply Gauss's law. Only now we have complete symmetry above and below. So we have an E due to these charges, which I'll call E self. And it's also going down. The same magnitude by symmetry will be E self going the other direction. So this is in the minus n hat direction. And so basically, by Gauss's law, E self times this area of the top part added to E self for the flux going through the negative direction cap, delta A, right? That is sigma over epsilon naught. Times the area. And so the magnitude of E self is sigma over 2 epsilon naught. And the actual direction, if I make the direction, then that is either in the plus n hat direction for above, in the sense of above outside of the conductor. I'm going to compare this problem to the conductor problem. Or minus n hat for going downward. Okay, so that's the field due to only these charges on the surface. And the point is that that is different than this problem because there were other charges in the universe that made this conducting material have zero electric field, that and all of those other charges in the universe are what changed this electric field to be zero inside from this electric field, which is not zero, below this surface. Okay. So the claim is that the other charges, what I'm calling, they must produce an E field which will cancel this E self going downward below the surface. Which is sigma over 2 epsilon naught n hat, because then that plus the E self will give 0 in the conductor, and it will give sigma over epsilon naught above the conducting surface. Okay, so charges don't exert a force on themselves, and so the F other, the force due to those other charges, that's going to now be taking the formula we had over there, sigma delta A, now times the E other, sigma over 2 epsilon naught, and then N hat. And so then the force per unit area, which will be the F force other divided by delta A, that will be the pressure or force per unit area, or we'll call that the electrostatic pressure. Okay, so that's the final result. That this is sigma squared over 2 epsilon naught n hat.